Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly.
And I'm Mike Philbrick.
And this is Raise Your Average.
Cue the good music.
Mike, what's a... Yeah, cue the music. Mike, we've got... how you doing, first of all?
Great. No shortage of things to talk about in today's world and the markets today. My God.
No kidding. It's been some pretty active weeks in markets with, you know, lots of recalibration happening and transition and rotation. Yeah. We had the software meltdown and then a little bit of a melt up yesterday. Not melt up, but a squeeze on that Anthropic news. I know that's just sort of the daily noise, but you know, we've got two of our favorite guests joining us today, and they're masterful at connecting the dots, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're funny.
Yeah.
They're funny.
We're going to tell everybody who it is. Jeff Winiger and Jeremy Forks
from Wisdom Tree. Yeah, exactly. No, I was holding out. I was like, yeah, who are you talking about? Yeah, it's
on the edge of their seats.
Jeremy Schwartz, Global CIO at Wisdom Tree, and Jeff Winiger, Head of Equity Strategy at Wisdom Tree, are our two guests today.
Yeah.
So I'm excited.
And they've been quite active, and obviously, Siegel is their
senior economist.
Yeah. So lots of wisdom that they can tap into. And as we were talking about, you know, the current environment of the rotation that's occurring both from large cap to small mid cap, or even large cap X, the, you know, large seven, Mag seven, sort of that equal weight versus market cap weight, you're seeing, you know, pretty clear and persistent rotation. So I'm looking forward to chatting with them about that. Is it, you know, is it true that the US always wins? And that's something interesting. As you pointed out, you know, if you look at the IGV ETF that represents all those SaaS companies, the SaaSageddon that's occurred since, you know, Claude Opus launching, and the subsequent events across the board, whether it be Altruist launching, financial planning tax software and the likes of Schwab and that sector selling off pretty dramatically. It is very interesting that the dynamics at play right now are incredibly dynamic, I guess. And when you think through that, you think of stocks as a forward discounting mechanism. You know, you're pricing stocks, there's their earnings and then the multiple on their earnings and the growth rate of their earnings that is being got adjusted in SaaS. And is that a temporary phenomenon? Yeah, is that a temporary phenomenon? Is that more permanent? I think some of what's being missed, so as stocks are trying to discount this future, which is wildly in flux because of the impact of AI, one thing I don't know that the market is actually contemplating is, you know, when the costs of things have gone down a lot, right? So the cost of compute, the cost of intelligence looks like it's dropping precipitously. When that happens, obviously you've got this multiple compression that's occurring, but I think what the market might be missing is that demand increases as the cost of something goes down. And what I think the market is, first of all, struggling with the initial adjustment in a multiple, but then what's the actual growth rate? And we can't see that yet.
Like, so I think investors definitely trying to figure out what, you know, is there a structural shift happening, or is there just a lot of tactical noise right now? And there seems to be like a lot of, you know, where to next sort of mentality. And stands to reason, markets have been really, you know, really strong until we've had this bout of volatility this last month.
You've got that happening. At the same time, you have all the resource constraints that we've talked about. You actually have the physical build out of all of the infrastructure required to support all of that. And that's, you know, that's to some degree where you're seeing rotation into commodities, you're seeing rotation into the commodity based economies like Canada, everything in Latin America. And so, you know, it's very interesting. There is a rotation going on.
And, yeah. So beyond software, obviously beyond technology stocks, then you know, we're also getting into the broader market and looking at you know, macro discipline, like how the shifts in macro are affecting global markets. You know, how, you know, the unintended consequences of last year's, you know, all this past year's policy making out of the U.S. is shifting sentiment, causing, you know, spending impulses elsewhere, like in Europe and in Canada, Japan. And we're going to talk about Japan today. I know Jeremy Schwartz has some very clear thoughts on Japan, and I imagine Jeff does as well. And then we'll get into also talking about rotation signals. What's actually, you know, is this a true broadening, or is it just an impulse?
Right. And that's going to be really hard. It's going to be really hard for advisors to somewhat fight that, because, you know, international diversification, diversification in commodities, diversification into even precious metals prior to the last 2 years have all been albatrosses to a U.S. 60-40 portfolio. And so we've got...
Yeah, a lot of head fakes.
And so the advisor and the clientele are feeling a recency bias. You know, in retail money has been flowing into the SaaS space, as an example, buying on this dip. Now, whether they'll be right or not, I'm not sure. Institutional money is kind of more selling. And so, as you said, is it a head fake? Is it real? You've got rotations into commodities and international stocks. Those have typically been fake outs in the past. And so the investor, just due to the behavioral biases that come in, is going to be restrained by their recency bias, by their home country bias. They're going to feel, you know, pressure from clients. International markets have outperformed the U.S. market. You know, if you look internationally, you look at Japan, you look at Europe, you look at Canada, all of these places are actually outperforming. And sometimes investors can be slow to pick up on the rotation. And what we have been seeing is the market cap weighted index kind of moving sideways for the last 6 months, while the equal weight index is breaking out to new highs.
Mike, these asset allocation decisions, like, we're not talking about abandoning U.S. stocks for something else. We're just talking about rebalancing. We're just talking about, you know, taking some of that excess return that has been produced by U.S. equities and moving it to other climes, to other markets. And, you know, the tough part, I think, for investors, behaviorally, is, and advisors, is those biases. You know, it's hard to let go of your winners, especially while they're still winning. Like, it's a lot easier if there's a big rout in the U.S. market. I'm going to move some of this money out to international. But you don't want to wait till that happens to make that decision.
This is Raise Your Average, dedicated to making you a better long-term investor. Join us as we sit down with some of the most interesting names in finance to discuss macro, markets, investment strategies, and more.
Good to see you guys. Good to see you.
How
good
you doing, Mike?
Very well. How about yourself?
You know, same old, doing my thing. This doesn't look like too bad of a background, does it?
No, it looks great, actually. I'm somewhat envious. Can you throw that in your roll that up and throw that in your duffel bag and send it to me?
It's lunch. Well, it's just the wallpaper.
Oh, wow. It's just a feature wall. That's great.
Jeremy, how you doing? Good morning.
Good morning. Good to see you guys.
Good to see you.
Good to see you as well.
In a hotel, I put a background on because I had the back. I was like, we're talking Japan. Yeah. I've got a good Japan background, so.
Exactly. But Jeff's got the good, like, he's got a feature wall in his hotel room. So it's just wallpaper behind him. I'm like, I had to do a feature wall at home like that. That's perfect.
Yeah, come on, Jeremy, get your background together. Look at this. I look like I'm in a real office.
Well, gentlemen, we've got Jeremy Schwartz, Global Chief Investment Officer at WisdomTree, and Jeff Winiger, Head of Equity Strategy at WisdomTree, joining us today. Jeff, Jeremy, welcome. It is terrific to have you guys.
Thanks for having us.
So we got it's been quite a active, brutal start to 26. We're, what are we, seven and a half weeks in? And it's been pretty clear that there's a lot of rotation. There's recalibration. There's a lot of, maybe a lot of overreaction. We got U.S. stocks at the higher beta end have been pretty frothy. And there still seems to be some mispricing going on about, you know, whether or not there's going to be more Fed rate cuts. And then we've got this marked rotation and wondering whether it's a structural shift or simply tactical noise, investors looking for alternatives to some of the frothy activities. So lots to talk about today.
Yeah, we say brutal. It depends where you were. You know, if you were in software stocks, the SaaS apocalypse, as everybody sees on a daily basis as we're recording, it's like this fear of AI completely disrupting certain businesses. And, you know, every day you get an Anthropic Claude release and who's next on the hit list. And, you talk about market efficiency and in general, you know, this sort of rise to passive investing has said, hey, we've got this efficient markets, but also there's a lot of you could say a lot of overreaction, and only time will tell, you know, how much is coming on the news. But it's, there's definitely some sharp dislocations in certain segments. And, you know, for the S&P is, as we're talking here end of February, it's kind of flat, but yeah. You've definitely had, there's some places where you had dramatic moves higher. And I think Japan is one of them. Some of the gold related things, the commodities have been prime focus points. It's definitely just a big rotation. And some of it we could say is long overdue. We do think, we talk about all the issues you talked about, but it's been disruptive for certain parts of the market and not others.
Yeah, I think if you talk about anything apocalypse or anything Mageddon, which is basically what we do, Philbrick, like as an industry now. I mean, remember last year we had Yen Mageddon and all these concepts. We're in the middle of XYZ apocalypse, as Jeremy said. It's SaaS apocalypse. But you have Korea is up like 38% year to date after being up a double last year. The S&P at what, 6850, 6900 PR, something like that. And to use the word brutal to describe the market it necessitates that you're hyper-focused in a portfolio construction perspective on software specifically. The U.S. is flat. You take core Europe. But Jeremy, how much is Europe up year to date? I mean, literally not even 2 months a year. 4 or 5% maybe on European equities. Asian equities in general in rude health. And here's the other thing. You know, I tend to talk about this, the stock market, but the bond market, at least the U.S. bond market, is in a tiny little bull market. So the type of person who is not these four rectangles on the screen, the person who checks a quarterly statement on a 401k or on a Morgan Stanley brokerage account, that person is in black ink year to date. And you wouldn't know it from, you know, I mean, it's just everything getting taken out on the AI trade.
Yeah, the thing that I'm wondering about too on that is, you know, obviously stocks are this forward discounting mechanism, and they're trying to deal with, you know, in the SaaS case, what's the growth multiple and what's the earnings multiple that I can now expect given these developments? And I think maybe I'd love your opinion on this. And what the market's missing is when things have collapsed in price, the usage has gone up exponentially. And I think what the market might be missing is as it's repricing some of these AI impacts, it's not thinking through how much more that the economy might use these tools if they're actually falling in price so much. And in the past, when you have that sort of thing, and we don't know. We don't have it's like the internet. Like, what's the internet going to do in 1996? Yeah. And then it comes in and sort of fragment. And sometimes the market's right. I think back to when, you know, we go back to BlackBerry days and RIMs out there. And then Apple says, I'm coming in and we're going to do these things called apps. And BlackBerry sells off immediately. And it wasn't till the iPhone 3 that we actually got, you know, the actual thing that the market somehow could foresee in its wisdom. It doesn't always get everything right, but you know, it corrected immediately and right away. And I'm wondering, you know, in this SaaS, again, there's got to be some truth to it. Is it are we at the overreaction phase now? And then the other thing is, on top of that, when you talk about the bond market too, is it a rotation, like, or is this a fake out? And, or is it the start of a bigger major correction? And there, I'd like to get your opinion on, but when I look at the bond market, I think bonds may be sniffing out, you know, as you say, a little bull market, maybe the sniffing out a little bit of weakness in growth, but it's not extreme, right? So it's not looking like an overall market correction. Like that, the other macro indicators to me aren't saying the market is in, like the S&P is in fear of having a large decline. More it's no. What's happening is you're having a really massive rotation away from some US equities broadly, away from some technology broadly, and into those international stocks, into those resource-based economies. Latin America's on fire, Canada's on fire. You know, so you've got resource-based economies doing one thing, you've got rotation in the S&P. It does not look to me like it's at the threat of a major correction, but more of a rotation. What's your take on that?
Well, it's funny that you bring the RIM example, because we were messaging on our internal group chats yesterday about that chart that went around on Twitter talking about, you know, like the iPhone comes out, it takes 4 years before BlackBerry really rolled over. And I was one of the last BlackBerry holdouts, so I loved the BlackBerry. I loved the little keyboard.
That QWERTY keyboard.
Now I've got a Mac, an iPad, an iPhone, you know, 17. So now I'm all in. But you know, it's very interesting. You know, and some of the corrections are bringing down what were very high valuations in many of these names. Now, some of the software names, I'm going to point to two that are, you know, or a few that are showing up in some of our value indexes, where you would have never found tech in value. We have some systematic funds focusing on share buybacks. You know, like when we started WisdomTree 20 years ago, it was very dividend focused. Jeremy Siegel, you know, my mentor, we talked a lot about dividends, and but also dividends and buybacks increasingly. And what you find now, we have one of these systematic buyback indexes, the top 10 is all software, actually. They're you know, you're getting value now, like 20% in software in some of the systematic buybacks. So these companies are saying they think they're cheap. Now you could say, well, is Adobe one of those companies like RIM, where, you know, it looks great, the earnings continue to look good in the rearview mirror, but hey, you know, its business is going to be dramatically different in the future. But it's also like you're saying Adobe's blind to what's going on. They don't see that AI is a thing, and they're not trying to figure out how to make their tools better and make, you know, keep their customers stickier for longer. You know, I think Salesforce is an example where, you know, you think my tech team is going to reprogram Salesforce versus just build on top of Salesforce. Yeah. Like our tech team, we have Salesforce, we use Salesforce, and we're building on top of it. We're not displacing it. It's why would we go back and reinvent the code? Like Jensen Huang talks about, like, are you going to reinvent the wheel every time you need to reinvent it? Or are you just going to use the wheel because it's actually pretty efficient to use, or a calculator? So I think, I do think some of it's overblown. There will be winners and losers. I mean, this last week, the cyber stocks started selling off in a major way because Claude had some release on cybersecurity. That is the last thing people are going to try to replace. Now, those stocks weren't cheap value stocks, actually. So some of it just, all right, we're correcting valuations. We have a cybersecurity ETF actually with an Israeli venture capital firm started by a lot of the elite spy units in Israel, called Unit A200, Team 8. And, you know, that the PE, the forward PE on that basket, like 25, 26, which is, you know, a few points higher than the S&P. S&P is now 22 times forward. You know, the big Mag 7, they've come down. They're over 30. They're now mid-20s also. And so I think some of the Mag 7 are actually now becoming more value stocks again. We could talk about that value growth characterization. But, you know, some of it was just adjusting valuations. But it's very interesting. I do think some of it's just overdone, and people, the fear trade selling off, and some of it just natural correction. Jeff, anything you want to add on that before we go to his other part of his question?
Well, I mean, this might go back to when Philbrick was mentioning, you know, when Research in Motion was in the process of getting disrupted, and I had the interesting perch, I guess you could say, because I was at BMO, this American for the Canadian bank, but in Chicago, and watching RIM circle a toilet, really, in those years. And that I had a company issued BlackBerry, I think probably all four of us did. And this new thing, you know, an app, like what the hell is an app? This is, I guess this is 20 years ago at this point. And how is this going to revolutionize the economy? Well, I can hypothesize from my 2007 perspective this way and that way and that way. But it did create all these new business lines. I mean, you know, just thinking about an absolute victim here in the carnage, Jeremy, one that's on everybody's tongue, I guess you could say, from the Citrini piece the other day with DoorDash. DoorDash, what's that? What is this concept? I'm going to push a button on my new BlackBerry, and then somebody will do a delivery as opposed to picking up the phone like I used to order a pizza. And so all these new business lines developed that you couldn't really conceptualize or felt distant future type concepts. And then we sprouted all new industries of people who were now app creators or working for a company that was app based. And this goes to one of the key concepts of which we don't know the answer, but we do have a sample size of infinity, all of history, and this would be the lone exception to the rule where theoretically it would be this new technology, AI, and we would not have job creation from it. And that's basically the bear case that everyone has. I'm not sold on it because it would be the first time that that occurs. Here in 2026, the four of us, we can't conceptualize what. Maybe I have a different job in 5 years. Maybe Jeremy and I are off doing something else that's financial services that we can't even, or maybe it's Wisdom Tree in general.
Precisely.
I mean, look at Wisdom Tree, right? Okay. If you had used the term tokenization 10 years ago or 50, that would have, like, what does that even mean? I don't know the term tokenization, but we invented it, the blockchain. And now Wisdom Tree is an ETF provider that is now moving boldly into tokenization because it's a concept that became a concept. And then we went out and hired people because, and it was a job that didn't even exist in very recent memory. So we need to slow down, I think, a little bit and breathe and remember that from each passing new technology, some new job ends up unfolding.
When you use a chatbot, like when you ask ChatGPT to, you know, analyze and write something for you. You know, like a student in college writing a paper, for example. Like you have to, once that's done, once that task, sure, it takes a minute or 2 minutes or whatever to create an essay or an essay frame. And once you're done with that, you have to go through it and make sure it's accurate. You got to make sure there's no hallucinations. You got to make sure that you know what the basis of that. I mean, that's, I'm just talking about something very simple here, not software or coding. But so you can imagine if that much follow-up work is required to ensure that what was generated by a chatbot is accurate, and you understand what it's done or how it worked. You do need to have, like, so for an expert, for a lawyer or, you know, any professional using, at a very rudimentary level, using a chatbot to assist in their workday, you still need to have the background domain knowledge to back up that product. Like if you guys use AI to analyze the market, you got to be able to go through the output to make sure that there wasn't some haywire step in between that mixed up all your results, the end results. And only you would know. Only you would know what, because you know what you asked it to do. You understood why you asked it to do what you asked it to do. And you can look at the work product of that generation, whatever it is, and say, you know, there's something wrong here or let's double check all this work. So somebody has to do that.
Well, or you could take it from this perspective, which is one of these middle of the road, what if the people over here just need to talk to the people over here on that ongoing? And maybe the answer is in the center of the bell curve. So think about this hypothetical, okay? Mike, you're making $100,000 a year, and you're expecting in a normal cycle that your boss is going to turn you to 105 this year, and then next year you're going to go up to 110. You're a middle-of-the-road employee. You're going to get a 5% raise. And instead, because there's some truth to the story between these two, it ends up being, you know what? You're happy to keep your job. We're going to keep you steady, Eddie, 100, 100, 100, and you're not going to see pay raises. But then again, when the washing machine breaks, you can probably just type into ChatGPT and repair this yourself rather than getting the guy out for $300. Because before, you were Google searching, you couldn't really put a photo in to, you know, figure out why is it leaking in this spot. Additionally, you know, Elon says the CyberCab is going to be delivered in 27. And I want you to think about the super commuter, right? In Chicago terms, right? Like maybe you live in southern Wisconsin and you are working in the loop. I mean, that's where the way I think Chicago. That's absolutely, your lifestyle is brutal doing that right now. But with the onset of a $30,000 CyberCab, you could theoretically be now laptop on your lap from southern Wisconsin into the loop, to and fro on a 75 or 90 minute commute both ways. And so think about what you can do. You could do the side hustle while you're in that. You could take a nap. You know, the baby was crying last night. So all these things that we think about are these side notes that are disinflationary and or deflationary that are the benefit to the key argument in the situation, which is, oh, we are going to destroy the middle class, or we're going to destroy the upper middle class, I guess it would be the argument. There needs to be a little bit of a tit for tat conversation when you start thinking about standard of living issues.
I mean, the history of innovation is that productivity gains go to real wages. And, you know, so if you look at it's a real equalizer, the sort of knowledge base transferring, like there's gonna be a lot of interesting startups that form and with very small employee bases, just because how much more you can do. I do think the young disruptive companies in a way have an advantage because they have less legacy issues. You know, you're not in some people have said they want to hire no new people. It's going to be very hard for the young people. I'll take the other side of that. I want as many young people as I possibly can get, because you know what? They are some of the sharpest minds. They innately are using the new technology, like more than people who have established protocols. Getting people to change their habits is harder than all you know is AI. You're going to, all you do is use AI. So, you know, it's just, if you think about just the long history of innovation, you had to know the world's body of knowledge to improve upon it. Like, when did we really industrialize? Like, we were basically hunters and gatherers until, you know, the printing press comes out and starts sharing information. You have now AI sharing information.
Sharing intelligence.
And so you could build on it and just get trained on what's out there. And then now you're really going to be limited by your creativity. Like, that is, you know, you could get it to do a lot, but like, well, do you have the right idea is like the most important skill and focus going forward. But I do think it's going to be huge. The innovation is going to be dramatic over the coming decade, and you're going to do a lot more. History says, like Jeff said, we're going to invent new. We don't know what those new jobs are today, but there's going to be a whole new fields. And it's an optimistic case. And now it goes back to how we started on the market rotation. You know, who benefits from all this? Is it just, you know, NVIDIA and the chip suppliers, or is it just the consumers of all this technology who are able to do more and figure out how to boost their margins? I do think some of that sort of small cap rotation that you're seeing this year, you know, part of why they were so bad, it comes back to also, you guys asked about the Fed and that some of the small caps was, hey, they're paying higher interest costs. Lowering rates is very helpful for small caps, and their earnings growth hasn't kept up. And if you're starting to see it, like some of our estimates are starting to see the small caps having better earnings than the large caps this year. And that will be the first time in a while. And if they really do learn how to use this tech in a way to boost margins, that's going to be the sort of lasting part of the rotation.
Yeah. I think one thing I want to come back to with Pierre as well, it's not that you won't need someone checking the code. It's that you'll just need one for every 10 employee you have now, because you've made each employee sort of 10 times more effective. So think back to the revolution that occurred. The Great Depression is a semi-good example, right? You had the mechanization, the rollout of farm equipment, and you had that disrupt the family farm. And the family farm was a small farm, many families on it. Those were consolidated and brought into industrial farming. And that created a pretty significant unemployment to some degree. Now, there was a whole number of other confounding issues in the Great Depression. Bank runs, lack of liquidity. So there was a number of mistakes made, probably you could argue, by the Fed that was in play at that time. So it's not everything. Certainly, you could make some mistakes as a central bank during a period where you're having the job dislocation. But one is that one person can do the work of 10. So what are the other 9 going to do? So they're going to do something else. And then it's how long is that dislocation, that retraining, that repurposing of the labor force, that is a big question in my mind. I think the Great Depression is too draconian a look. I mean, you could do that if you made some serious mistakes with providing liquidity during those periods. But it's not the threats are not without some validity, obviously. Mm-hmm. But coming back to the rotation. So Jeremy, what you're seeing in the rotation side is actually rotation, not some sort of cataclysmic market event that's kind of brewing. Or how yeah. are you viewing that?
Well,
when you look across
and
sort of cross asset validity.
We've had this 15-year bull market in mega cap tech, and it's like dominating everything. So it's like US growth versus value, small versus large. The international companies haven't had any big tech. So they're more like a value index. So they've been out of favor for so long. Now, the last 12 months, the US is the biggest underperformer versus, you know, emerging markets outperforming, Japan leading this year, some of the markets higher. But I think there's real things happening. I think it started, part of the case for Europe started with really a lot of the geopolitical events and the increased spending that they're calling for, spending more in defense. And I'm calling it a defense tech super cycle. Like, so people think of just, all right, should we just buy the defense stocks in Europe or the defense stocks in Asia? Asia happens to be one of my, you know, I think where you really do need a lot more spending. And actually the Prime Minister in Japan is calling for a lot more spending in Japan. And that's going to filter through all out Asia, Korea, India, all of them. But so while that is a very specific play, if you abstract and you go back to, again, the history of innovation, where did some of our greatest techs that we use today, your cell phone, the internet, come from? They have roots in spending on defense. So like the defense spend kicks off just new innovation. Like you think about drones today, like what Ukraine is doing with Russia in drones. Well, we're all going to be getting packages delivered by drones eventually also. Like, you know, you're just going to see all sorts of this defense crossover. And so I think that defense tech super cycle is a key part of that longer term. Like, this is not just a this year event. This is the next decade, the US was the only game in town for real tech stocks. Expect to see more in Europe, expect to see more in Japan, expect to see more in Asia generally. And that will, you know, be part of the catalyst of the longer term cycle. I think that's a key new development.
Yeah, I like that.
That's very interesting. I mean, that's a really, I think that's almost the, I think that, that's the first time I've heard that take, Jeremy.
Good.
Which is, how does Palantir fit into that?
You want not a cheap stock, AI, for sure.
You want defense in AI. I mean, that's. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the flagships for AI and all the memes going around is people are about to find out why Palantir trades at 300 times earnings. But, you know, it has come down and it is growing dramatically. I mean, it's definitely not one of those value revenue stocks like Adobe or Salesforce, but it's at the key intersection of defense and AI. But a lot of, you know, the part of the story is a lot of these companies are staying private for longer. So like Anduril being, you know, the key, but there's going to be so many interesting robotics startups that are coming, you know, the humanoids. You got right now Tesla is like your main public facing thing, but there's all sorts of other plays. Physical AI, I think, is one of the key next stories that we're focused on as just where is this all stuff going to come to fruition. But again, I think it's going to abstract and there's no more, I think big trend, this sort of super cycle, AI is driving a lot, but this defense tech is the other big thing.
I know, Pierre, you have like 100 questions you probably want to ask, but can I take the German build out and go with a concept? I have a concept. It's good.
Go for it. Go for it.
Right. Here's the deal. You guys, this is a pretty nasty sell-off in the dollar. And it's like, well, what is Weniger talking about the dollar now? Jeremy's talking about Palantir, now it's the dollar. Well, okay, think about it from this perspective. We had, until very, very recent memory, the German black zero, which was law, which was, and this is a wild idea, maybe we should talk to people in DC about it. We're going to balance revenues with spending. Imagine that, and have a balanced budget, and it was called the black zero. And then, of course, the Russians went into Ukraine, which is now 4 years ago, which, I mean, talk about time flying. And now, in the back part of this decade, the Germans are going to have a deficit to GDP ratio that's going to be like in the high threes, closer to four than three, who knows, right, by 28, 29. And so what oftentimes I think happens, and I'm an American that talks to Americans generally, with the exception of this call, about the U.S. budget deficit being totally blown out for years, basically aside from a few years in the 90s, being blown out for my whole life, and especially blown out during COVID. And therefore, that we must be always dollar bears, da-da-da-da-da. And you say, well, hold on a second. Is nobody else also blowing out their budget? I'm selling dollars. I'm selling A to buy B. Maybe I'm selling dollars to buy euros. But at the same time, we need to take note that suddenly everybody, the Japanese too, everybody has decided to ramp up their defense spending, whereas with the Americans, it's more like social welfare spending. And to the extent that you are a dollar bear on account of a 5.8% budget deficit to GDP ratio, as per the CBOE, or as CBOE, CBO, for 2026, we need to put it in some context that everybody is about equal on these matters. Now, the other concept here that I think is critical is, anecdotally, guys, have you come across a dollar bull lately, a U.S. dollar bull? Nobody, except for, I guess, me and Jeremy. I mean, back of the envelope, I think hardly anybody is dollar bullish. If you look at the B of A fund manager survey, I don't know if you guys saw that about a week ago. They had a record in negative dollar positioning. And we did a crude chart over on Twitter showing the dollar index. Put the dollar index on the top and then slap that beneath it because we're taking the screenshot from B of A. And it coincides essentially with that dollar low about 5 years ago or so. The last time the bears were so numerous, you got a huge snapback rally in the greenback. So contrarians take note. I think
it's up with the magazine cover indicator. Our friend JC Peretz loves to put all the charts on the, you know, the peak of the dollar and the bearings and the Economist headlines. And then you have like this snake picture recently on, you know, the dollar coming out, and then Barron's had a cover on the demise of the dollar this weekend. So it's, you know, it's definitely in the spirit of, for sure, everybody is talking the weakness of the dollar in many different ways. Now you can say gold, like what is gold manifesting? Like gold in some ways comes back to the debt and deficits, but also dollar fears and the geopolitics. A lot of it's coming out of Asia. I think it's very interesting. I think a lot of people don't have enough gold. I've been saying for as long as you guys have known me that people don't have enough strong dollar bias in their portfolios. Like, you know, we're talking about people bet on the dollar's demise way too much in their international allocations, that the dollar is actually a decent diversifier. And then Japan, it's like very, very evident why you wanted to hedge the currency over the last 12, 13 years. You would have lost half your return, like literally 7 versus 14% a year since 2012 if you didn't hedge the dollar. But it actually, earnings come from around the world in the U.S. And, you know, so you already have a weak dollar bias in the S&P earnings in many places. But gold, coming back to where I was going to go on gold, you know, it's very interesting. What do you think is the neutral allocation to gold people should have if you did like a passive portfolio? Mike, what do you think the normal number should
be? It's about 12%.
There you go. That's the number. That's exactly what we do.
We're on that. We've been espousing the value of gold in a portfolio from the perspective of hedging a different set of risks, right? You always get the pushback, has no cash flows. And it's like, yes. No, that's a feature, not a bug, right? Things that are scarce, they have to be bought by somebody else from somebody else in order to appreciate, fine. That's the scarcity aspect. That's the why the cash flow doesn't matter. If we need more Beanie Babies will be produced. Unlike gold, like it's very difficult. And so absolutely. So from a market cap perspective, you'd kind of be in the 10 to 12% range, right?
Now, Mike, one of the things that's very close to both of our hearts is how do you add things into portfolios? And, you know, I think one of the things because of that issue of like, all right, what are you going to sell to buy gold, right? Like, that's always the question. Like, well, do you want to actually reduce your stocks? Do you want to reduce your bonds? Some people have said, hey, the new commodities, you know, the 60-40 should be stocks and commodities instead of stocks and bonds. Yeah, I've seen that from that stuff going around. But the, you know, I think both, you know, what Mike's team is focused on and my team, you know, we've been doing these capital efficient portfolios with stocks and bonds to add more gold, but then actually doing more direct gold overlays. And so we have one of our faster growing products is gold on top of equities, but we did recently gold on top of tips. So as a way to sort of add gold overlay on top of tips, and that's sort of a brand new concept, GDE and GDT for the equities with gold and tips with gold. But you know, I do think that's a big idea that people have been under allocated. Even if I might think people don't have enough strong dollar risk from the one perspective, gold is just a whole different animal. And I think it's I'm glad you're out espousing the same 10 to 12% would be neutral.
And you start to wonder, go ahead, Philbert.
Well, I'm just like capital efficiency. For those who may not know what Jeremy's referring to is capital efficiency in portfolios. And there are a number of ETFs that WisdomTree offers, as well as our ReturnStack brand, which allow you to add those diversifiers via addition, not subtraction, right? So capital efficiency allows you to put some leverage in your portfolio, but it's diversifying leverage, right? So that in the context of a 60-40, many people will opt for a 50-30-20, right? Take 10% from stocks, 10% from bonds, throw them into an alternative. It could be managed future strategy, it could be gold, those types of things that are non-correlated and add value so that when you add the two volatilities together, it's actually a lower volatility, not a significantly higher volatility, and you get the diversification built on top. So that while the diversifier is struggling, take gold sub the last 4 years, where it's sitting there not doing much, it doesn't take away from the portfolio, but it's there for when you need it. And the capital efficient opportunities for ETFs, you can also build your own design, right? I think the first one you guys did, NTSX, was, you know, here's a 90-60 portfolio. And now if you buy that, you can keep some cash, build your own alternative portfolio, and not give up those stocks and bonds that your clients know, love, and trust, and that they hold you to the tracking error of. And so there's an outperformance aspect as well as a diversification aspect to this capital efficiency that Jeremy's mentioning that both of us are big fans of. So I just wanted to make sure we kind of highlighted that more broadly so that people knew what you're talking about, Jeremy. So back to the regular programming. Back to
well, on gold, I mean, like when I was a babe, it was you need the dollar to be weak in order to be bullish gold. That like 25.
You still are a babe.
Thank you. Don't pay attention. It's
don't put yourself down.
My wife said
she was hot. Buddy. The salt and pepper's hot.
Everybody's doing it.
Every young kids are putting gray in there.
And then if you look at this cycle, I mean, look, in 2025, the dollar was weak against basically everybody except for the yen, and gold did really like it. So we don't want to say that's no longer, I mean, of course, dollar weakness tends to help. But there have been a lot of bouts in this cycle where gold made its big, bold, multi-year move, where the dollar was strengthening and gold was still also in bull mode. And that was very surprising to me, Jeremy, because that was not really the way I was trained when I was a babe. Now, the other thing, if you go back about a year ago, the 10-year T-note last spring, 475, something like that. And if you think about where we were last, like the first quarter of last year, it was the fiscal spending from the Trump administration. There was going to be the fiscal blowout, which didn't make any sense to me because we're going to have tariffs, which is fiscal restriction. But that was the story. And that we were going to be flirting with a 5% 10-year T-note. And that was the reason you didn't want to own the S&P 500, gold, or any of these other concepts. And then we spent all of last year rallying the bond market. And now we're flirting with 4. And, you know, we just had the mortgage, the 30-year conforming mortgage in the U.S. just went back south of 6 the other day. And if you think about gold, it's an opportunity cost. I can get 5% in a T-note. Do I really want this? Yeah, I always say Krugerrand in the shoebox or something like that. At 4%, that argument becomes a lot less bold, and certainly at 350 or 3 or something like that, if the bond market should rally. But then also the critical thing that's different from when I was a, you know, coming of age, turn of the century, gold bug type is there's this other thing sitting out there that's being liquidated right now, and that thing is Bitcoin. And did we have a situation where, as we had the fiscal blowout through all these years, the reflex was, uh-oh, I want to get out of fiat currencies. Let me get into this new thing that's just been invented 15 years ago. It's called Bitcoin. Rather than doing what Jeff Weniger would have reflexively done, which is buy gold. And that now that Bitcoin has decided to have a, oh boy, 40, 50% sell-off from late last year, I think there's been a lot of that, okay, I'm liquidating Bitcoin. Now I have this capital from the proceeds of my sale. I must buy something. And that something logically has been gold and silver. And so you could very, very well have a situation where we rally the bond market on disinflation as per your CPI work, Jeremy, a disinflationary backdrop through the rest of the year, maybe into 2027. The bond market likes it. Gold likes that the bond market likes it. And gold and silver continue to be a beneficiary of this Bitcoin liquidation. I think that's a very, very reasonable setup. And it's basically my base case.
Well, just the final point on gold is that I think the typical investor in the US, just measured by the, now you can say people have those bars of gold stacked away, but I think the typical, just looking at the liquid market, so ETF markets, we're almost, you know, 14 trillion, less than 2% is in commodities. It is shockingly low. So very underallocated. Like when I just came back from a trip in Europe, their ETF market is a quarter of the size, called 3.5 to 4 trillion. And they have they have the same amount of commodities. So they have the average allocation to commodities is four to five times higher in Europe. And they say, they've had more experience with actually needing gold on currencies. They don't care about equities, their equities. You know, like a German pension might be 10% equities versus, you know, our pensions are much more. I think they should be more in stocks too. I think they have too much defensiveness in some of that. But I do think we are underallocated, and I think finding ways to bring it in would be more optimal portfolios.
And on top of that, Jeremy, you look at the allocation to those in the S&P 500. right? So metals and mining, what, 3%, oil and gas, 5 to 7%, right? You had a dominance in technology from a market cap perspective. This isn't 2006-07 anymore, where Exxon was the largest company in the S&P 500. That's not the world we live in. And so the sort of typical passive investor who's got a, you know, largely American 60-40 has de minimis exposure to these assets that perform structurally different when regimes shift to, you know, sort of a more inflationary growth environment. So disinflationary growth, great for US stocks generally, those help the tech stocks. But inflationary growth, where you do still have some growth, but you have that inflation side kicking in, that more benefits, you know, the resource-based economies. And right now, you look in your U.S. portfolio and you look in your S&P 500 and you have de minimis weightings to those return vectors that are so diversifying to a truly diversified portfolio. And that's just a happenstance of market cap drift. And so, you know, it's interesting to hear what's happening in Europe, and they certainly prioritize gold, you know, given the outcomes of World War II. They have those memories.
When the flows are starting to go there in equities, like if we look at just, I don't have the exact numbers, Jeff and I were reviewing them on a call earlier this week, but it's like the emerging markets and foreign developed, you know, are now more than U.S. large cap blend as a category through, you know, February. It's
wow.
It's like 70, Jeff, I don't know if you remember the exact numbers, but it was the international between developed and EM higher than US large blend. And that's been a while since that's happened. Now, if you look at the typical allocation, ACWI, I remember when we started 20 years ago, it was 50-50 almost exact dead on. And then the US was outperforming, we got up to like 2/3, 1/3 in ACWI. Sort of what's neutral. I think most investors we come across are like 80-20 US foreign. They've been so under. But it's so they're playing catch up a little bit now. I'm probably a bit more cautious on China as part of the EM, and EM is still, you know, very heavily dominated by China. And yeah. I think with all the geopolitics happening, I mentioned Asian defense is one of my top ideas. I think that is a risk I'm not as comfortable with. I like Japan, I like India as our strategic allies in Asia versus the China that's in most, you know, traditional indexes. But, you know, I do think it's a sign that they're still probably very underallocated to that international side, and you're starting to see some of that money move on that performance.
And so what's the good takeaway for the advisor here, right? I guess the takeaway for the advisor is, listen, if you're one of those guys with or gals with 80-20, maybe you need to kind of look at your allocation here and start thinking about a path to a more neutral market cap, at least allocation, in order to keep up with the performance. I mean, you know, you go back to the sort of late 90s into 2000, right? You had this same sort of dominance of technology, international stocks, real estate doing nothing. And then from 2000 to 2007, you saw a pretty dramatic, persistent shift. And so for advisors, this looks to me, especially when you talk about the flows and what's going on, this is not a trade per se. This seems to be a persistent reallocation by, you know, large money to make sure that they've got exposure in these areas that we're talking about. But so first of all, is that true? So this is more of a rotation that's got many years ahead of it. I think that was your conclusion there, Jeremy. And then second, okay, I'm an advisor. What do I do now? First step is probably look at the allocation. Next step is compare it to market cap, see where I am. Maybe third step is to have a plan to move towards getting an allocation that's more neutral. I think some of the ideas you had on Japan and India as being key components might be well served as well. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is where getting some deep dive portfolio analytics is helpful. I mean, that's one of the things our team does. We do have a portfolio consulting team that could help if people are saying, like, where are they exposed, underexposed, what's the plan to get to neutral, and sort of talk about sort of this sort of shared CIO framework we do, where we collaborate with groups to try to help them figure out the holes. That is a key thing that team does focus on. And but I think you got to really do think, like, how much of is your portfolio reliant on one key set of risks? If 80% is the U.S., you're very levered to the Mag 7 trade versus all these other things. And you see the last 12 months, you know, it could be a longer cycle. The U.S. outperformed by 500% ex-U.S. for 15 years. Right. And, you know, yes, we had stronger earnings growth, but we also had some multiple expansion. You're starting to see it in many of these places with real earnings growth. Like Korea, as Jeff said, up 38%.
Year to date.
The key stocks are cheaper. The key stocks are cheaper. Like, yes, Samsung and SK Hynix are like small single digit PE stocks. And again, it goes back to the only AI winners aren't going to just be the Mag 7. Like Japan has a lot of the key AI, key infrastructure companies. You can't build these semiconductors without a lot of these Japanese companies. SK, you know, the memory part of Samsung, SK Hynix are surging, and, you know, their earnings have been surging. So it's, you know, they've just been left out. I mean, I'll give Jeff credit for Korea. Like, if you go back to his Twitter feed years ago, like right before the market was taking off, he was talking about the value up program in Korea and saying, this is a very cheap market and there's a lot of things happening. That is one of his top ideas. We were talking Japan, he was talking Korea, and it's you know, he was spot on that one, and it's still a cheap market.
I don't know what this Twitter thing is that you're talking about. I don't know what
it's X,
I mean, look, you get to the point where you're having a 20th birthday since your original ETF launches. That's going to be happening this summer. So when it comes to, let's say, developed equities, we have this laundry list of currency hedged ones, laundry list of unhedged ones, right? It's on the table which one you want to pick, right? We got a bunch for everybody. It's an established brand. But the issue is you're 80-20. Let's say we're going to go with this 80-20 between the U.S. and then the sum of developed plus emerging. The popular refrain is, am I getting in too late? Have I missed this? Everything melted higher in 2025. I'm looking to get to, I don't know, 75-25. Have I missed the boat? Da, 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 da. I know that the second I pull the trigger on this, it's going to reverse and my end clients will be crowing. I mean, you guys have heard this all through the years. And it's true. And it's true, right? The old refrain, nobody ever got fired for buying IBM. Which might be a wink, wink, because wasn't IBM down like 12% the other day?
Claude Code. Claude Code, yep.
Nobody ever got fired for buying Procter & Gamble. But you did get fired through the years for buying some other exposure, European equities or something like that. And what we found now that you have these 20-year histories on a lot of this stuff, is what you don't want to do is lose more money than the next person when the bear market comes. It might be okay to make less money in the bull market. You don't get as much pain in the portfolio from, oh no, we're down 20, but everybody else is down 12 or 15, that type of situation. And what we find historically and logically, that it's when the stock market is declining, generally speaking, the euro declines relative to the dollar. Some of the other currencies are a little bit more iffy on it, like the yen sometimes does an opposite direction. But that's where the pain point is. And so when you're in the unhedged mandates, you tend to be fully exposed to the vol mechanism. Whereas when you currency hedge, we're now starting to see on these 10 and 15 year numbers, vol metrics that are lower than our own domestic indices, like the Russell Mid or even the Russell 1000 on our EFA mandates. So you can almost, from a risk budgeting perspective, easily do that 80-20 move into 75-25 or 70-30, and maybe even past tense, change your vol metrics to something that's more advantageous. And I just simply think, guys, most people don't realize it. I'd say, Jeremy, wouldn't that be, that's the number one obstacle we have in terms of getting someone from maybe to yes, in terms of bringing assets into WisdomTree, is having them realize, oh, I can find a DM mandate where the vol metrics are actually lower on real time horizons. It's the number one thing.
Well, it needs to be diversification. Like you don't want diversification. Like it just was constantly making your portfolios worse to do anything but the Mag 7. So the longer this trend, you know, now it's not like now it's the U.S. is on the lowest end of the totem pole at the moment. Last 12 months, even year to date, it's struggling. So It's how much conviction do you have this is a longer theme? And when I tell you this sort of defense tech super cycle means they're going to get a lot more tech, a lot more innovation, this is not a one-year trend. The valuations are supportive. The more people become convinced, you could have real money move, and that would like really magnify it. I think it's starting, but we'll see how much it continues.
And the numbers.
I think one of the remarkable things, like, it seems like in the past couple of years, like, technology has become everything. AI has become the secular overarching sort of theme to all of these decisions. And, you know, because it affects the business ecosystem at every level, every sector is affected ultimately by the AI decision at the very basic level. But obviously at the technology level, like if we're looking at Japan, for example, you know, they've got this huge semi-cap sector in Japan where, you know, or companies like ASML or TSMC, who are integral cogs in the machinery of the build out of the infrastructure for AI. We're looking at the energy sector. Now the discussion centers on data centers. You know, a lot of the discussion, not all of it, but it's such a large component of that discussion that it's sort of inescapable that ultimately everything sort of comes back to this AI center. Right. And everything sort of revolves around it. So again, Jeremy, to your point about the defense tech, it makes a great deal of sense when you put it in that. I guess the question is, you know, the hard question to answer is U.S. mega cap dominance cracking, or is it pausing, or like what's going, is it a broad structural shift that we're seeing? Is it something that investors, advisors have to take very seriously and say, well, you know, we can't depend strictly on this one market? It's not that we're saying get out of the U.S. We're just saying rebalance.
And each one is going to have its own idiosyncratic story in terms of like the drivers. Like I do think we've been saying, you know, Meta and Google, like when people start saving money, what are they going to do to reinvest that in? They're going to reinvest it in marketing their products. Like, where are they going to spend the money? They're going to spend it on Meta and Google. So, like, you know, there's some of these things are still going to be winners. We're recording before NVIDIA's earnings. It'll be, you know, they never misses earnings until they do one day. But you need the NVIDIA chips, and there's just insatiable demand. To Pierre's point is, it seems like at some point you're going to need more energy than chips. Like, chips won't be the bottleneck, but energy will be the bottleneck. But, you know, so that's a time coming. You know, I think something like Tesla, when people make the analogy to tech of 2000 in the tech bubble, you know, like when at some point in 2000, you had like 9 stocks with triple digit P ratios getting to be like 30% of the S&P. These tech stocks today, I said, they're mid-20s in general. Only Tesla really is in a whole new world. Like, it's in that 200 type range. And so it's really a bet on a very different future, not just the car company. It is on its self-driving, its robotics, and being a key AI player, but not just the economics of its current business. So that's the one that's the quote unquote hardest to justify. Everybody else is kind of, you understand why the valuations are. And so it'll be relative earnings growth over time. And, you know, the international just has a lower barrier. There's smaller numbers. You know, Japan, even after this run, the number of our Japan portfolio is 15 to 16 times earnings with earnings growth that's competitive with the US. I mean, that's a pretty good place to be, you know, 8 points lower and 7-8 points lower and competitive earnings growth. So I think, each stock will become a little bit more bifurcated. There's been talk of all this passive flows. Is this driving all of them up together? I think you're seeing more dispersion again, you know, and that's a positive. It's not just the passive flows all the time. Like, yes, there is some of that that's clearly been impacting things, but dispersion has been useful.
What do you think is the biggest mistake advisors make translating macro into allocation?
Well, you could go on and on about this sort of macro and the Fed and what are you going to do? And then you get, and even with geopolitics, we say, you know, you could get defensive and say, hey, I think there's all this risk out there with Europe being in a war. I'm not going to go to Europe, but look for the, actually, in all these uncertainties, there is opportunities. So the geopolitics has created a lot of places that can benefit. And so looking for the things that, you know, catalysts that stand to benefit, I think are useful. And, you know, uncertainty does create these opportunities and better valuations, better attractive points, not to get overly hunkered and afraid at the moment. You know, we do think AI is still generally very positive. Growth can be good. Innovation is going to be very good. Margins are going to improve. Fed's cutting. There's a lot of very positive backdrops with uncertainty, but that uncertainty, you know, keeps the valuations reasonable for you to get in.
Do you guys realize that I think we just set an all-time podcast record? I don't know how long we've been recording, 45 or 60 minutes. And I think Jeremy's reference to the Fed might have been the longest any macro type pod has ever gone. Like, we haven't even think about, I mean, I've been talking about the bond market a little bit, but I don't think any of the four of us has said the word Jay Powell or Kevin Warsh in this 45 or 60 minutes.
Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Yesterday's story.
The biggest mistake that advisors make was what Pierre set this up. Then Jeremy said the Fed, and I'm like, oh crap, that's the answer. Think about it like this. The Fed cuts rates on day one, therefore it is going to have an effect on the market on day two. No, it doesn't work that way at all. It never has and it never will. Bernanke starts easing policy and then you wait a year and a half or two before the crisis ends, and maybe 4 years if you're thinking about the Greek crisis and the Italian crisis and so forth, where Bernanke is acting in 07, 08, but you're not even out of the woods until 09, 10, 11, 12. And there's this lagged effect. Now, this is a little bit of a funky cycle in that Jay Powell gave us all of that fourth quarter of 24 rate cut action, cut by 100 basis points. Remember, the Fed funds rate was 5.25 to 5.50. And then in the fourth quarter of 24, which is now six quarters ago, slashed by 100, went on pause, and then in recent memory started cutting again. One of the big mistakes we make is we forget he started doing that, because we all have these goldfish memories of the clickbait cycle. We are going to, maybe now, maybe this spring, maybe this summer, maybe this autumn, at some point you start hitting 15, 18, 21, 24 months after the original rate cutting cycle commenced. That's when the monetary mechanism filters in. Got a lot of bears out there, which is really weird because, like Jeremy was saying, it's really just software, 6,900 on the S&P 500. You go on that thing I've never heard of called Twitter, and it's nothing but bears. It's nothing but doomageddon. And you start saying, you guys, have you realized that we're going to now get a filtering in, probably in 2026, from Jay Powell's 2024 actions? A big macro mistake to forget that. And Pierre, that's what I would pinpoint here in terms of allocations for the next few quarters.
That is one of the big misconceptions, right? Is that, like, we tend to look at it in terms of the immediate reaction in the stock market. Yeah. You know, when there's a, you know, when there's an anticipated rate cut, and I mean, it's already priced in, whatever is anticipated is already priced in. But then, you know, it's the old saying, right? Better to be a mystery than history, right? Like, soon as the rate cut comes, the market has an unexpected, you know, reaction, or when the announcement comes that there'll be a rate cut, or when consensus gets made, the market, you know, rarely behaves the way people expected it to. Like, you know, even last year when there was rate cuts, the year before, immediately people thought that, you know, that would translate into lower ultra long yields, like 30-year yields would come down. And then, you know, you'd have that duration opportunity in buying long bonds. I mean, investors were, you know, some investors were loading up on TLT, right? And that has not panned out the way people had hoped it would, or at the very least, it's been quite volatile. But if you consider, you know, that the assumption was that if rates get cut, long-term yields are going to drop. It took quite a long time, and you explained that very well earlier, Jeff. That you know it took quite some time for the 10-year to drop to 4, mm-hmm. and you know it has oscillated between 4.5 and 3.5. But in the most recent period, it took quite some time for it to drop from the 4.5 range to 4.
Yeah. And I mean, it's what people always say, well, I don't really understand why it takes a little while. Why does it take? And there's no right answer. Maybe I've always, in a lot of my charts through the years, I found my number tends to be 18 months. And I think a good example, we'll pick on Philbrick here. So let's say behind him, he needs to do a home renovation. We're going to take that piece of art down. We're going to move the backpack and the lamp. And he needs to get a drywall guy in. Now, Jay Powell starts cutting in September of 24, and he's doing it till December. But it's not until, let's say, February or March of 25 that Philbrick goes to take out a home equity line of credit. And he saves 100 basis points relative to if he had gotten the quote in the autumn. And then now he takes out the HELOC, and now he's servicing that HELOC in April, May, June, July of, you know, last summer. And it ends up changing his household balance sheet materially from his prior estimation if he had engaged that home improvement the prior year. Or, better yet, it prompted the home improvement, giving jobs to the drywall guy who's now outspending his money at restaurants, too. But additionally, now that the Philbrick household balance sheet has been alleviated of that 100 basis points on their HELOC, you start to see it as Philbrick decorates the room in, you know, maybe Thanksgiving or Christmas time of 2025, when he buys a better television than he would have when overnight money was 5.25 to 5.50 and so forth. But all of this stuff takes time to filter in. That's why when Powell's cutting in the fourth quarter of 24, you're sitting here in February of 26 talking about it, because it starts to show up. And it could conspire with, for example, Jeremy, how much has Sam Ryan's been talking about tax refunds over at our shop? Tax refunds, that's fiscal policy. 2025 actions on the fiscal side showing up in a boost in first and second quarter. Call it almost like one of these refund checks that George Bush used to give, the $300 refund checks. The typical person's going to get about $300 more on the tax refund this year. All of this stuff starts playing into marginal propensity to buy a Harley Davidson, marginal propensity to buy an F-150, marginal propensity to go out to Chipotle, all of these things. And it's just lagged effect, big macro. I think we're okay as an economy here in 2026.
Right. Yeah. Not to mention all of the fiscal spending that's planned.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, on top of that, you have this lagging of easing, but there's also fiscal. So, you know, whether that's in the defense tech that we, you know, Jeremy was talking about with Europe and Japan and in Asia in general, that is a global trend. And it's structural. It's not something whimsical. It's actually a structural plan. Those are spending plans for the next 5 and 10, right? So you can actually make projections based on that goal of NATO members raising their defense spending to, what is it, 5%?
Well, and what's I think interesting is that the history, the speed of innovation, like how long it took for things to get just developed, I think is speeding up, you know? So like where the spend that led to, you know, from the walkie-talkies towards your cell phone, or just the ARPA DARPA spend that became the internet, just the pace of innovation, the new spend on defense, I think will have more consumer applications and more exciting things faster than it did in the past. So you just got to be prepared for more change.
And one of the things that we were writing about it earlier this week, so I have the numbers fresh in my mind, and where the narrative is not borne out by the data is sometimes where you can get an edge on things. And Jeremy and I mean, as you could see with Jeremy's got the little thing says invest in Japan next to him. We do a lot of Japanese research, and I'm going to guess, this is just a wild guess. I'm going to guess that 99 out of 100, forget the general public, investment professionals, financial advisors, don't realize that the Japanese debt to GDP ratio has come down. Exactly. And I'm going to also guess the same 99 out of 100 don't realize that the U.S. debt to GDP ratio has come down. This all peaked during COVID. Fitch was putting out earlier in January. The Japanese debt to GDP ratio peaked at 220. And by the end of this decade, it's going to be in the 190s. It's coming down not because the debt burden is going down, but because simply nominal GDP is rising at a faster pace than the debt accumulation. Earlier we were talking about, look, I'm the first guy, 5.8% budget deficit in the United States. That is nasty. Let's say it's 5.8, and let's say you get 3% real GDP and 3% inflation. Now, I actually think the inflation part of that's the bigger stretch, but that would be 3 + 3 = 6. Your debt to GDP ratio would decline in that setup. So there's a very, very real situation that the U.S. debt to GDP burden and or the Japanese, and or let's just take another big economy like the German economy, that it just goes sideways. And I think most people think the chart is just going to be up and to the right, and that's why they're bearish bonds and bearish the system and the whole thing. I got to get Bitcoin, whatever they're arguing. It's the narrative is not being borne out by the actual data. And that data has been improving in the case of the U.S. for it was Q2 of 20. So it'll be, well, I guess 6 years this summer on that. Very interesting stuff, in my opinion, if you're wonking out on debt dynamics.
Aren't we all still digesting the 25 years of deflation story for Japan?
Really? You have to start asking serious questions about demography as an investment thesis, because that was what we heard for all those years until basically Abe turned the system around 2012, 2013. And that's basically why the China bears growl now, because China will end up having the same demographics as Japan. Well, not the same, but similar concept. And you start thinking, well, if you're the Japanese industrial machine and you're exporting to the world, maybe it doesn't matter what's happening on your own island, as evidenced by the wondrous performance of Japanese equities over the last more than a decade. And we start thinking about that because it's creeping into the conversation as it pertains to things like U.S. equities, where what's our birth rate, Jeremy, like 1.7 per woman, maybe 1.6 at this point. You hear that type of thing with, not to belabor, Korea, which, you know, was mentioned earlier. In Seoul, the birth rate is like 0.6 per woman. Total collapse in demography, but don't tell it to the KOSPI. The KOSPI keeps rising. And so that's one of those things where maybe the weight that we put in demography earlier in our careers was X, and maybe it needs to be half of X in terms of generating bear cases. Maybe it's not as important as we thought. I'll end up with egg on my face maybe with that one, but that's where my mind is going.
Layer on top of that, Jeff, the potential for robotics and autonomous workers, and and now you're dislodging the whole economic framework and theory, because it's, you know, land, labor, equipment, labor, land equals production. Well, what about, well, labor's not human anymore. And just look at the autonomous driving, right? That just look at that as one example of how that can be dislocated. And demography then becomes almost irrelevant from the perspective of productivity and the economy and so on. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, and see if you have all of this robotic innovation and people are left with nothing to do. Maybe they have more kids. I don't know. Who knows what happens?
You're right. The baby boom for years, and it never seems to come to pass. But I thought that during COVID. Mike, I remember you and I were talking about this years ago. I said, well, to the extent that more people will be working remotely, it frees up so much more time as you eliminate the commute. And then basically the cost of child rearing is not dollar amounts. It's dollar amounts plus sleep deprivation, plus walking in your front door at 9 p.m. because of soccer practice and all these things. And that the work from home revolution would increase the Western birth rate, the North American birth rate. Boy, was I wrong, completely wrong. So I always try to come up with these reasons why people will start having more babies in the West, and it never comes.
Here's where you're going to be right. Taylor Swift gets pregnant, and then every woman in her cohort wants to go through the raising of a child with Taylor Swift, and the whole world has a baby boom because of Taylor Swift's pregnancy. It's going to be amazing. I just want to circle back to Japan because that's a big thesis that you've got. And what have we missed on that? Jeremy, we've talked about, you know, overarching macro details, things about how to allocate. Maybe we'll wrap with that, some ideas for advisors. But before we go there, I'd love your take on Japan. And I know, Jeff, you have covered the small caps in the U.S. a bit, but, you know, I wouldn't mind you giving us your a pitch on what you think, or what else is going on. I know Jeremy in Japan is a big deal. And what else is, what's your top idea, Jeff? If it's not small caps, something else.
Okay. People know our flagship DXJ with the currency hedge. It was one of the first funds to do that. And really, when you talk about sort of the underlove of Japan, sort of peaked at 20 billion in assets. Now it's like 6 billion. So it was like a few billion like at the bottom. So it was one of those things that had a lot of popularity in 2012. It soared in 2012 to 2015, and then people abandoned the idea. So I think it's been an underappreciated. But yet, when you look at how many things have outperformed the S&P 500 internationally since 2012, like there's a handful of things. DXJ is one of them. Like, it really actually kept up in the last 13 years, but again, driven by earnings and dividend growth, not from multiple expansion. Like, the U.S. is driven more by multiple expansion than Japan was over the last 13 years when it was up 14 to 15%. Now, the question from here is, all right, so Takaichi comes in, landslide victory. We talked about her initiatives, which is the most important for investors is really the defense orientation. But even overnight, she put in two new members of the Bank of Japan, two academics who are a bit more dovish leaning. She sees, you know, Trump would berate Powell being too late, too slow, which actually we agree with generally. We think the Fed should be even a little bit lower. But, you know, they're going to do it a different way. She's nominating some new directors. She doesn't really want them raising rates. But, you know, she's got to be, the currency is not like when Abe came in, when it was 75 yen to dollar, it's 155, 156. It's not a dramatically overvalued currency like it was back then, but she still doesn't want the Bank of Japan dramatically raising rates. You know, so I've been telling people for the last 5-6 years, follow Buffett into Japan. I probably written 6 pieces, follow Buffett into Japan. And, you know, he's got 5 companies that he wishes he could own more of. He owns 10%. He says he would own 20% or more, but he's sort of constrained. Well, we created this Japan Opportunities Fund that has almost half the weight in the Buffett stocks. And like that, the idea was, hey, Buffett says he wishes he could own more. Let's do something that gives you direct exposure to those. And then find, you know, who are the candidates, the type of stocks Buffett would like. People doing a lot of buybacks, people growing dividends, good earnings growth. But also have some flexible budget to find these key players for defense, key players for AI. And so it's a more flexible, you know, if you think of WisdomTree just as systematic dividends, you know, WisdomTree 20 years ago, this is a more, as it's called, opportunistic idea, where it's got a little bit more active curation to it, a little bit more flexible on the currency. Right now it's fully hedged. We've been thinking that somewhere we're speculating that Japan was going to intervene and send the yen higher. We took the other side of that and said we actually think it might still trend down. But we do have, you know, systematic momentum components, but with a committee that oversees it. But so I think OPPJ, a little bit newer fund, but in terms of just people getting awareness of it, it's got a long history. But it's, you know, repurposed last year to this sort of new curation. And I think it's my favorite part of the Japan story. I sort of personally moved most of my Japan into that position, and still think very, very reasonably priced.
you wouldn't see a 5 to 6% allocation to Japan, which would be kind of a market cap position.
Yeah, but and no. I have way more. I'm personally.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
What do you think is the top thing that people get wrong about Japan? I think for most people, Japan is kind of a mysterious place in some ways.
Yeah.
What do you think it is that people completely misunderstand about Japan or to get wrong to begin with?
Well, the last decade, it was the currency. So they bet on the yen. And so that cost them 7% a year. Like, I mean, we're talking returns that compounded 150% since 2012 versus like 500%. So they really, really messed up how they allocated. And, you know, you're still paid 3% to hedge. That'll come down as the Fed cuts. But you're still paid to hedge. It's still a cheap market. It is driven by real fundamentals. People worry like, oh, the demographics are declining. So is it about Japan's economy or just the global economy? And so I just because they didn't have a flagship name like an Apple didn't mean they were key to the tech story. So they have a lot of the key infrastructure behind these semis. And so I think there is good tech exposure there too that is coming. Partly they were trading with AI for a while because they have some of the key components to all of it. But the biggest mistake people made was betting on the yen. And it's like, no, you don't have to buy Japan for the currency. Actually, you know, being neutral of the currency could be really the best play, which is what Buffett did. And that's also why I kept coming back to do what Buffett said. He said he could have, no matter how smart you are on currencies, like he didn't think he could hire somebody who could help him time. So he just hedged it. And I was like, that is the way to go. And really more people should follow Buffett.
And that fund that you mentioned with the Buffett style portion in it, that's hedged as well? Or does it come in both? Hedged,
it's a little bit more tactical. It's Opt-J. So we do move the hedge ratio around. We're probably, you know, biased more to hedging than not, but it has a systematic component to it and it will be flexible.
Perfect. Love that.
About
what about you, Jeff? What do you got?
Yeah, Jeff.
Okay. Well,
or whatever. There's something more compelling.
My best idea is the dollar, and I'll tie the dollar in.
Okay, tie the dollar in and how it might play. How might you play? Okay, so we've got this underestimated dollar strength. Yeah, this huge turnaround 4 weeks ago. Dollar strength. How do we play it?
Do not look at the dollar as your reason for small caps, which is the opposite of what everybody else. Oh, the dollar's going to do this, therefore I like large. Dollar's going to do that, therefore I like small. What I have found historically is that dollar directionality has very, very little bearing on whether or not small beats or doesn't beat large. My best idea is the dollar, for reasons of it's extremely oversold, a bearishness abounds, and all the stuff we talked about a year ago or an hour ago. Now, in terms of the broad market, we oftentimes say the S&P 7 and the S&P 493, but nobody really talks about like the Russell 2993. It's really weird we don't do it that way. I think it's because most people don't know what the Russell 3000 is, frankly. It's simple as that. So the Russell 3000 would be the sum of large plus mid plus small. And if you look at the action, do we have to be bullish or bearish on the MAG 7? Do we have to think the MAG 7 is going to do this or do that? What if it just does this? What if it just does that? There's a real possibility, and you can see it in the tape, where as a collection, the MAG 7 just decides to be dead money for a while. Think about turn of the century after the original 2000-2002 crash, where Microsoft just decided to just chill out for about 11 years. From 02 to 2013, it was just dead forgotten money. And in that cycle, so you have the nasty bear, but maybe you don't get that, who knows. But those are the environments where the trades of yesteryear, you lose patience with them, you lose interest in them, you just become disinterested. And now it's 2002, 2003, 2004, and you are long oil, you're long China, right? Value, all of these things that you didn't really consider in 97, 98, 99. And that, I think, is the reason why Russell Mid, Russell 2000, those are up mid-single digits year to date, while the S&P 500 is flat, so you're up 500, 600, 700 basis points on both mid and small relative to large. It's just that the old concepts of really October 2022 until a few months ago are starting to be off, and people are looking for new ways to play it. That's why this whole pot we were talking about, what to do with that 80-20, how do we actually get European equities? Jeremy's talking defense stocks, and 3 or 4 years ago, it was all ESG. And it was defense contractors. Are you kidding me? That was the, and the conversation completely flipped. Markets change, cycles change, the industry changes. And there's a very, very real possibility that we just had the run-up into the technology. The technology becomes known and absorbed in the popular psyche. And now it's time for us to move on to something that goes beyond that. That's why from October of 22 until basically the autumn, it was all Mag 7. It was all tech, all comm services. Energy left for dead. You started to only see things like utilities running for the conversation we had 20 minutes ago, which was as the side note play to the AI build out. And now you get into the situation where, oh, we're all going to lose our jobs. And anybody who's in software is going to be completely obsolete. But by the way, the S&P 400 and the S&P 600 are up 6 or 7% year to date. What? I can't rectify these two things. So the narrative is disconnecting from the reality. The Russell 2993 is in rude health. It's just these 50 or 75 stocks, maybe it's 100 or 200 stocks that are really, really taking it on the chin. Most portfolios are in the black year to date. So I'll stop there.
And on the tape, like, you know, you're seeing this now. So the Mag 7, if we go back 6 months, has a total return of like 6%.
Yeah.
And small caps have a 14% return. So that's on the tape, you know, like that's what you're saying. You can see it happening. If you look at the last 6 months, that Mag 7 is kind of, you know, sideways, and other markets are outperforming, and that's rotation. It takes rotation of capital to make that happen.
And we were pulling earlier this week, and I imagine it's still the case, there's 11 sectors in the S&P 500. So now we're going to talk large caps here. And if you look at the last 3 months, I mean, because this thing's got a little dicey in the last 2 or 3 weeks, but if you look at the last 3 months, everybody is up except for financials. Financials are down, you know, like 3 or 4% in the last 3 months or so. But every single sector in the broad market is up in the last 3 months. When you think about your original days of reading Richard Russell and all that type of stuff, in terms of you need to have X corroborate Y, which needs to corroborate Z. You want to see the Dow Industrials going up. You want to see the Dow Utilities going up. You want to see the Dow Transports going up. That seems like a pretty good trifecta. Everybody is in a general bull trend, with the exception of software, with the exception of a few of these disruption plays. Until that evidence changes more, you really shouldn't change your opinion. Give me March, give me April, give me May. Maybe it changes. But for now, there is zero argument for any type of market internals-based bearishness, as far as I can tell.
Agreed.
Interesting. But there's no, I mean, there's no shortage of worry, though. That's the disconnect, right? I mean,
when has there not been a shortage of worry?
But that's not, I mean, like, it's what you're saying, like, I it's not a consensus. It's just, I mean, because of the conflicting activity in the market, the activity in the market that conflicts with what we're talking about right now, that's not a consensus that there's no reason to be anything but bullish.
You know, I've given some thought to this, and I lay this one on Jeremy. When we say the consensus, to me, the consensus is the stuff I saw scrolling through Twitter and forming my consensus in the last 24 hours. Like, wow, everybody on Twitter is really bullish this, really bearish that. Now, I want you to think about the person who really goes deep on 3M and Coca-Cola. And they know 3M and Coca-Cola really, really well. That person's not on Twitter. But who is on Twitter a lot? I guess we should be calling it X, Twitter. It's Bitcoin people. It's people who own software names because that's cutting edge. It's the future, all these things. And these people are really, really in pain. People that put half their net worth in Bitcoin, that type, or somebody who's got a portfolio and it's really XLK, you know, and or what have you, or they bought Oracle. And these are the people who we believe are forming consensus. But what about, I always say, like your brother, the dentist, who doesn't check but every 90 days his 401k. He might be in a much better mental state of affairs. And so we have the S&P at 6,900. Consensus is super, super bearish. But is it? I'm not quite sure. I mean, when I look, I guess it's Jeremy's 401k is doing fine.
Jeremy has Japan and silver. I mean, that's all. He's just Japan and silver.
Yeah. Gold in Japan is like Jeremy's kicking butt this year.
That's great, Jeff. Well, 12 months from now, guys, what surprises advisors the most or investors?
What do you got, Jeremy?
That's a good one.
I think it's going to be the dollar.
Well, that's a good one.
Put me for the dollar for reasons I explained earlier on the pod.
Probably think cryptocurrencies probably surprise people a lot too.
To the upside?
To the upside.
Does that mean gold takes a breather, or are you going to run together?
I think so. The action in both gold and silver has been a little bit climactic. It has not taken out the big trend. The big trend is still in place. But generally, when you get those kind of rushes, you guys have experienced it before, there's some consolidation for, a period. It could be 3 months. It could be 6 months. And, that's probably where I would say I think you still want the allocation. I think you still want to be looking at rebalancing. I tend to look at consensus through the lens of market capitalization. And I think this is a really important point to make for any advisors or individuals managing their own portfolio. What's neutral? Like, what would your neutral portfolio be? You have no bets. You're going to hypothesize for a moment that you don't know the future in any way, shape, or form, and that markets are somewhat efficient. And so thinking through that, what is your neutral portfolio? A portfolio for which you would take no bets at the moment, mm-hmm. right? I think knowing that initially then allows you to say, okay, what are the tilts that I would want to impart, right? So if I'm thinking about, global equities, well, what's the global equity market cap and where am I compared to that? And is that the bet I want? So in the 80-20 case where you're 80% US stocks, that's a huge overweight to the dollar, to duration, to technology. And so, is that what you want? And is that the bet you're actually wanting to make? Or is that an allocation that has happened because of performance, some recency bias, some behavioral bias, and really kind of sitting down and looking at what market cap portfolios are positioned as? That's a pretty smart allocator globally, not just in the US. Mm-hmm. And then thinking through what is my neutral portfolio given my risk parameters? And then thinking about how might I think about the things that we've talked about today to alter that positioning. And I think using the tools like WisdomTree provides with their portfolio manager counselors or consultants, we do the same at ReturnStack. Your ReturnStack tools, there's advisor tools for you there to put your portfolio in, to x-ray it, to look through those maybe unintended tilts that you have and make sure that they're intended. Would be, sort of how I think through, what is consensus. And I think you hit an amazing point there, Jeff, on consensus is whatever you scrolled in the last 24 hours. Wow. I do think, to some degree, there is a lot going on with Trump and the media that's creating a lot of general media consternation, which causes people to maybe look at their portfolios in a slightly different way as an overarching sort of meta position that we're in now. But yeah, that's how I would think through it. Jeremy, what do you think?
I love what they both said. So I'm going to just echo it. I think they, I love it all. I think that was beautiful from Jeff and Mike.
Is it safe to say that the overarching sort of sentiment is uncertainty, and that the markets continue to climb this wall of worry? Despite,
there's some panic, which is really, really weird, because it's not manifesting in the tape. Again, you're like 1 or 2 percentage points off the top in the S&P 500. The VIX, VIX is at what, 21 or 22, Jeremy? Something like that. So I don't know if I want to call VIX at 21 a panicky type VIX. And also remember that the VIX for bonds, which is the MOVE index, is has been in a downtrend for a few years, and there's a lot of stability in bonds. But in terms of the rhetoric, the things I'm hearing from people, they're worried about their white collar jobs. There is a panicky voice that I'm hearing, and I wonder whether it's not so much the portfolio, whether it's their own careers. In terms of the word uncertainty to describe this, I would say it's particularly uncertain right now, in a bizarre twist of affairs where it's uncertain, but nobody's actually taken a real loss. Nobody who's diversified has taken a real loss. It's a funky, funky situation right now.
Jeff, Jeremy, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight. It's I was saying in our pre-chat that you both are some of our favorite guests, and you have you're eloquent, you're great storytellers, you're terrific at connecting the dots and making certain things that are otherwise complex to understand much easier to digest and much easier to understand. We love you guys.
Well, thanks for having us.
Appreciate that.
Great conversation.
Appreciate that a lot.
Appreciate being here.